Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Coming up later this hour, should PTA donations be limited by law so kids in some neighborhoods don't get thousands more dollars spent on them than kids in other neighborhoods in public school? That question is raised by new findings on our education website, schoolbook.org. We will get to that second this hour. First, since the beginning of the financial crisis, one of the most heated conversations has been whether the meltdown was an unfortunate worst-case scenario of an otherwise productive financial system, or whether the collapse was a result of intentional and corrupt behavior on the part of some on Wall Street. I think we know where Charles Ferguson stands. His film Inside Job tried to expose criminal behavior on Wall Street. Remember his Oscar acceptance speech?
I must start by pointing out that 3 years after a horrific financial crisis caused by massive fraud, not a single financial executive has gone to jail, and that's wrong.
So Charles Ferguson expands on that, and maybe he can answer his own question. In his new book, Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. Charles Ferguson, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much for having me, sir.
Why a book, by the way? Did your movie Inside Job, and with all the splash it made, winning Best Documentary Oscar and everything, not make the case well enough, or did you uncover something new, or why a book?
Well, both things. First, there are, of course, some limitations to what you can put into a film. I wouldn't want to have people sit in a movie theater watching legal documents for 2 hours. But secondly, also, in the roughly 3 years since I made the film, we've uncovered a great deal of new information, primarily through private lawsuits, also through a few government investigations. And we now have a substantial, still incomplete, but substantial record of what occurred.
And one of the fundamental questions is, in the years leading up to the bubble, whether those on Wall Street realized the downside potential of these complicated mortgage-backed securities. You're right that assuming most investment bankers were not cretinously stupid, they were either, one, innocents being defrauded by brilliantly evil mortgage bankers, two, stunningly complacent and oblivious, not bothering to look at what they were selling, or three, in on the scam. And then you say, well, it probably wasn't number one or two. But why do you think it was a scam? Why do you think it was a conspiracy?
Well, it wasn't a single conspiracy. There were, of course, many firms and many trading groups and so on involved. But was it a scam? Yes, it absolutely was. And we now know that they knew that it was at many different levels, ranging from the people who constructed and sold individual securities, who knew that they were putting together defective securities and who lied about their characteristics when they sold them, to internal corporate decisions that firms were going to start betting against their own securities, and indeed they were going to start constructing securities for the purpose of making them fail so that they could profit by betting against them, to the even larger scale questions of corporate governance and public statements about accounting condition, Sarbanes-Oxley violations when people certified the adequacy of their internal financial controls, the CEOs of these firms. So we now know that there was a great deal of not only unethical but criminal behavior in what occurred.
But an argument in response is that many banks did collapse, many CEOs and, you know, financial quote-unquote innovation whiz kids did lose their job. Surely no senior manager would willingly take a bet if they knew there was a decent chance that their entire bank would go under, right?
Well, there are two responses to that. One is that, astoundingly enough, Wall Street was set up, its incentive structures were set up in such a way that actually many people, including quite senior people, even people who would lose their jobs in the event that their institution failed, had strong incentives to do things that were destructive to their institutions and to the whole financial system because they personally made more money that way. But there's no question that also there were very, very serious failures of corporate governance at the very highest level. There were several CEOs and boards of directors that really were just completely out to lunch and had no idea what their own employees were doing and what the characteristics of these things were and how dangerous they were. And they just were very content to continue to be oblivious and play golf and bridge and smoke weed as long as they kept making tens of millions of dollars a year, which they were.
You think a lot of bank CEOs smoke weed?
There's no question that Jimmy Kane did. There have been many, many public and media reports about it. I'm far from the first to take note of this. But actually, the smoking weed is the least of it. I mean, what was even more striking, Jimmy Kane, by the way, was the chairman and CEO of Bear Stearns.
Probably really expensive weed.
He probably could afford the best, yes. How good his taste was, we don't know. That's another matter.
Do you have evidence? I mean, why do you think that also not seeing the risk were people like Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, who was at the New York Fed at the time, thinking, and they were looking at risk. There were some people who were raising the risk of a mortgage collapse, and they looked at it and they said, well, I guess this is possible, but we don't see the huge risk in it.
Well, I think that in the case of Greenspan, it was a combination of personal self-interest and ideology, and I think that both were very strong. You know, he had spent almost his entire career in the private sector as a private economist, and in some cases, by the way, taking money from very dishonest people in order to represent their interests. He was paid by Charles Keating to say that Keating was a safe and sound and reasonable guy during the savings and loan scandal.
Keating from the SNL crisis in the 80s, but that was a long time ago. And it's a pretty serious charge to say Alan Greenspan, as Fed chairman, would have been making economic policy or monetary policy in his own personal interest rather than because he thought that this was good for the nation.
Well, I think that the ideology was important, too. I think that both were present. You know, the self-interest wasn't just narrow in the sense of his annual income. It was, you know, all of his pals. What parties does he go to? What dinners does he go to? Who likes him? Who doesn't like him? And his whole community, his entire career, had been these guys, and they are guys. But the ideology was also important. I think that he was also a true believer. He was a disciple of Ayn Rand for a long time. And so I think that both things were important. Perhaps the same is true of Bernanke. I don't know Mr. Bernanke personally at all.
Charles Ferguson, my guest on WNYC. You know him from his film Inside Job, which won the Oscar a couple of years ago for Best Documentary. He has followed that up with a book now called Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. And lots of the book and your work is devoted to the question of how high the blame goes. What about the opposite? How far down the chain do you think the willful scam, as you see it, goes? Were everyday employees in these banks in on the scam as well?
Many of them were. Many of them were, particularly in the mortgage lenders that were giving out these mortgages like candy. There's no question that a lot of lending officers and also, of course, mortgage brokers who were not their full-time employees but with whom they did business, a lot of lending officers and mortgage brokers, that became a kind of quasi-criminal industry during the bubble, and it attracted a lot of dishonest people who had little or no experience in finance, some of whom even had criminal records.
You also point out that there is not only an incentive to be corrupt in the system that existed, but there was also a disincentive to be ethical. How so?
That was one of the most striking and I have to say depressing things that I found when doing this research, is that there were, of course, many honest, ethical people in the system during this period, and a number of them actually tried to speak up. And what I found was, and what they found was, that every time they tried to speak up, they were shut down hard. And in some cases, they lost their jobs. In other cases, they were suddenly transferred to someplace, you know, in the middle of nowhere. One man at Citigroup went from managing 220 people to managing two because he had written a memo to the senior management of Citigroup saying these loans are very, very, very bad, and this is going to cause a huge problem. And several other people at AIG and Countrywide and other firms also lost their jobs, and in some cases, substantial amounts of income as a result of being honest.
Dan in Bridgewater, you're on WNYC with Charles Ferguson. Hello, Dan.
Hi. There is a center in the brain called the amygdala, and in all primates, it makes sure that two things. One, that you engage in behaviors that have positive consequences and you have the appropriate emotional reaction. Another one, that when the consequences are negative, you have the appropriate emotional reaction. And if you look at that, the behavior of these people, some of whom I knew during this time, there was this tremendous elation at how they got away with everything, and there was this tremendous depression that they didn't do it ahead of the next guy. And that's where the government comes in. It should have slammed down hard on the first guys who did it, and because it didn't, and because they got so rich, everybody else trampled over their own personal morals and everything because of the socialism of consequences, where the consequences dictate exactly what they had to do and what they could not afford to do. And the one thing they could not afford to do is behave in any moral way. It's the same thing with war, except this is a sort of phony war where people don't fight. They just play fight. And it's like a video game.
Let me get an answer. It is not many caller that goes from the amygdala to the socialism of consequences. So, Charles Ferguson, you think he's onto something?
I do, actually. I mean, I'm not sure that the caller was obviously a very enthusiastic man. I'm not sure I would use exactly the same description, but there's no question that there was a very powerful kind of cocaine-like high to making money this way, and this is often a problem during bubbles, by the way. You know, being in the middle of a bubble, particularly a rapidly moving financial bubble, is just tremendously exciting, and you know, everything is great until the crash. And there's no question that part of what went on was there was a lot of adrenaline, there was a lot of testosterone, there was a lot of literal cocaine, and there was this culture of, you know, speed, excitement, money, and nobody was getting in the way of that culture. There was, you know, there were no breaks, no restraints.
Let's jump to the last chapter of your book before you go, and that is what should be done. And you offer your bullet point list of ways to begin fixing this corrupt system. Surprisingly, the first thing on your list isn't restore Glass-Steagall or strengthen the Volcker Rule. It's education reform. Why so?
Well, there are two aspects to that. One is a very broad one. The second half of the book makes the point that what happened with the housing bubble and the financial crisis was part of a much more general pattern to what's been happening to the American economy and to American politics. And in the large scale, this country is in very serious trouble with regard to the education of its population. And the United States now has a lower high school graduation rate than many supposedly developing nations in Asia, for example. And equality of access to an opportunity for education is now much decreased in the United States and much lower than it is in many other countries. And you can't build a modern economy without an educated population. The other narrower thing, which I go into detail about in the book, is that the economics discipline has been quite substantially corrupted by special interest money in the same way that our political system has, and we have to do something about conflicts of interest in academic economics, because those are the people whose expertise supposedly gives us objective and independent guidance about how to run our economy.
So, bottom line, your book is not just about the past and what led up to the financial crisis, but some structures of corruption that you think are still in place and need to be addressed before the next crisis?
Yes, very much so. If we don't fix this, we'll have another crisis in another 10 or 15 years. And like many people, I'm far from alone in this regard. Many other people have made this point. Joe Stieglitz at Columbia, Paul Krugman, many other people are warning that this country is going in a bad direction. I hope that we fix it. We often have in the past, and I hope we will do so again.
Charles Ferguson's new book is Predator Nation, Corporate Criminals, Political Corruption, and the Hijacking of America. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, should PTA donations be limited by law so kids in some neighborhoods don't get thousands more dollars spent on them than kids in other neighborhoods in public school? Or maybe there should be some kind of a tax, in effect, where the wealthier donors to PTAs have some of that money siphoned off to the poor neighborhoods. We will ask those questions, which are raised by new findings by our education website, schoolbook.org, coming right up.